this week on The Inside Flap.
I like walked around the block like 16 times before I could go into the building. I'm like, oh no, these are like writing heroes here, and I'm going to stumble in here and come up with ideas. I mean, I guess the lucky part is that, you know, the show is about prostitution and pornography, so they really did need women in there. So, they all sort of speak in these like long paragraphs that are so beautifully crafted, and it's like, and I'm saying, I don't know, you know, they should be smoking in this scene.
And as I'm falling, I feel myself heading straight for the guy who's gotten off the trail. He's looking at me with his huge saucer eyes. I'm flailing, trying to stop myself, kind of kicking, trying to look for something to grab onto as I feel myself plummet. I'm heading straight towards him.
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado. This is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Sitting across the table to my right is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
And resting comfortably, looks like he's got some new kicks on, kicked up.
Oh, they do look new.
On the floral settee is Andrew Dowd.
Andrew's tan also.
Yabba dabba doo!
Oh, yeah, okay. Testing out every week. He's testing out.
I need
out
a new one.
He's getting new.
Yeah.
You are tan. Is that a
it's different from, I don't know that it's from Hawaii because I didn't notice it.
It's probably left over from Hawaii.
Must be.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah.
All right. Well, in any case.
Looks good. You look healthy.
Welcome to The Inside Flap. We have a great show for today. We've got book recommendations. Of course, we've got
audio book of the week
stories. And our special guest today is Edgar Award-winning author Megan Abbott. She's the author of 10 novels, including You Will Know Me, The Fever, Dare Me, and The End of Everything. She's also the co-showrunner, writer, and executive producer of Dare Me, the TV show adapted from her novel. Her new book is The Turnout. Laura read it, really enjoyed it, and we'll have that chat for you momentarily. But first, now, you know, we are based out of Colorado, as we're here, in the great state of the Centennial State, as it were. Andrew, do you know why we're called the Centennial State?
No clue.
Oh, Laura, would you like to inform the class? First of all, spit out your gum and inform the class why we are called the Centennial State.
We were founded in 1876.
Boom. That is correct. Yes. And 100 years.
And that would have been my guess.
And that's why you guessed.
Would have been his guess.
Yeah, would have been. But you didn't. The point is you didn't.
We recently just had the anniversary of becoming a state.
Now, do you know which state has more 14,000-foot mountains than any? Now, there's an easy one.
That's
Andrew,
an easy one.
Which state has more 14,000-foot, which are called 14ers, 14,000-foot mountains in the country?
So I'm guessing Colorado.
Oh, look at that. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, boy.
Yes, Colorado. So there are 58 mountains in Colorado that are considered 14ers. Second most. Care to guess second most, Andrew?
I'd go with Alaska.
I would,
ooh,
too.
Oh, yes. Both of you would have been correct. How about third place?
Washington State.
Yes. Alaska, you are incorrect. No, I'm sorry. Not Washington State. Although there are two in Washington State.
Montana.
No, I'm sorry. This is home to the tallest mountain on the continental U.S. Lower contiguous.
I thought that was Washington State.
No.
Is it Portland, Oregon, then?
It is Mount Whitney, which is located in...
Where?
Its symbol is a bear.
California?
It's going to fall off the ocean.
Why didn't I know this? Did you know that, Andrew?
No.
I thought McKinley. Oh,
that's Alaska.
And it's not called McKinley
anymore. It's called Denali now.
Denali. Mm-hmm.
So we have 58. Alaska has 29. California has 12.
I had no idea. I almost don't believe you.
And Washington State
How come Californians don't ever post about doing 14ers? Because they've got the beach.
They only have 12. They got the beach. They got L.A. That
tells
Hollywood.
You how awesome, not awesome, it is to hike a 14er. When you've got the beach, you're going to go to the beach and you're not going to post yourselves on
climbable?
14ers. You know, actually, I do not know. I'm not sure how technical they are. I will say that every one of the 58 mountains that are 14ers in Colorado are climbable. There's no technical skill involved, although there are some class 3. It goes up to class 5. There are some class 3 moves on some of them. Some are easier than others. But with school rapidly approaching, I decided to tackle another 14er. Now, I've climbed 21 of them so far out of 58. And it had been a couple of years since I'd been on top of a 14er. And I got jealous looking on Facebook, some of my friends who'd been up there. And I was like, you know what, let me, it's the time.
It's right now when people are starting to go. You're seeing the photos.
Only a couple of months out of the year where you can easily climb them. Now, some people do climb them in the winter, but they're a little bit, a little cuckoo. For Cocoa Puffs, I will stick to summertime climbing.
That's what most people do. California ranks their mountain peaks on a scale called the Yosemite Decimal System. Isn't that weird?
Really? That's strange.
YDS. Class 1 to Class 5.
The Dewey Decimal System is only, Class 1 to Class 5, that is how you rate.
But California calls it the YDS.
Well, maybe they call it here as well. I don't really know
enough
about it.
I don't think we would use Yosemite as a...
Huh. Or the decimal. I mean, the fact
maybe we have a different name and it's decimal system.
I don't know. In any case, I decided to tackle Mount Missouri, which is out near Buena Vista, which is actually looks like Buena Vista, but it's pronounced Buena Vista. And I'd also heard that right next to Mount Missouri were Mount Belford and Mount Oxford. So you could, if you felt good enough, tackle all three peaks at once, so you get a little bonus. Now, there's nothing easy about climbing a 14er, including what time you have to get up in the morning. So the night before I set out to climb the Missouri, I set my alarm for 2:30 in the morning. And of course, because I knew I had to get up that early, I literally just tossed and turned the whole time. Finally, I grabbed my phone and saw that it was 2:20. I said, you know what? Close enough. Let me get up out of here. Went down, hit the 7-Eleven, grabbed a large coffee, and it was onto the road. Made it to the trailhead at exactly 5 o'clock in the morning. Now, only in Colorado, or maybe some of those 14ers in California, I don't know how they work out there, but only in Colorado can you get to a trailhead at the end of a long, bumpy, dusty road at 10,000 feet, at 5 o'clock in the morning, only to find a stream of cars pulling into the parking lot and a line at the bathroom.
I guarantee you California's the same.
I'm sure.
Because we know California. That's what they do. Also, I was looking up this website. They have a California 14ers guide. It is very popular. It's just something
you don't really hear about it.
It's like a big deal for them to bag all the 15 14ers.
Well, it is a big deal out here. 15, does it say they have 15? I thought they had, my research showed 12, but sometimes it depends how close they are to another one.
It says 15 mountains in California. Okay. Only 12 of them are considered true 14ers, though.
All right, so what that means is some of the peaks might be too close. There's not enough what they call providence, so they don't rise up enough to be considered true. It's considered part of the other mountain.
I'm guessing.
I don't know.
Huh.
But anyway, in any case, the reason you have to be up so early is you don't want to be stuck above tree line. And around here on the 14ers, tree line usually occurs. Maybe it could happen around 11,000 feet, 12,000 feet. Once you get above tree line, that's it. It's just rock. It's rock, maybe grass, maybe a little bush here and there, some pikas, and of course the yellow-bellied marmot. And mountain goats, but that's it. It's you and the sky. And if a storm, the ever-present afternoon storms, when they roll in, there's no place for that lightning to go except your head. And I think it was Mount Princeton. I got within, I would say, maybe a football field away from the summit when the storm that was coming in started flying in, and I looked at my climbing partner and his hair was standing on its end. And his metal climbing poles were sparkling and making noises like a radio trying to adjust an AM radio station.
Yeah.
I was like, you know what? The mountain will still be here another day.
We were on a hike in Estes Park, and we weren't even above tree line,
that's right.
And we had that
the
happen.
Same exact thing
I looked
happened,
at Sylvia, and I saw her hair standing up on end.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Scared the crap out of me.
So much electricity that's just in the air.
I started yelling, get down! We need to get down!
Yeah, yeah. And that's what somebody told me when I first came out to Colorado. Is like, if that happens,
get down
on the ground. Yeah. Lay flat, get down on the ground.
Yeah.
And throw those metal poles as far as...
Throw the metal poles, yeah.
Throw the metal poles off the mountain.
What I did was I ran down... At that point, I ran down the mountain.
You kind of have to. You have to retreat.
So that's why... So you always get those afternoon storms. You want to be... off the peak at the latest by noon, but you want to even try to get there earlier than that. So the funny thing is when I'm there in the parking lot, what you see is there's a lot of nervous energy going on, a lot of people walking around, and it's pitch black, but everybody's got their headlamp on, so they're like gathering their supplies, loading up their backpack.
Had there been people that had camped down there, probably?
People camp right near the trailhead, absolutely.
Like
some
car
people,
camp,
yeah. I've slept in my car before at the trailhead, and just a lot of nervous energy going on, and a lot of once you hit the trail and you start going up, and like immediately you go up through the woods and hit these switchbacks, and you can look above and behind you, and all you can see is these bobbing little lights going
headlamps.
On. So it's pretty cool.
So I'm thinking that this would be a perfect opportunity
for a murder.
Ooh.
For a fake Bigfoot sighting.
Andrew thinks Bigfoot, I think murder.
You go murder. I was thinking murder too. But either or. A murder or Bigfoot.
We're both.
That's right.
Yeah, both.
That's right.
That's true. It would be a perfect opportunity. I did not see Bigfoot. I saw pikas and yellow-bellied marmots. I did not see...
Mountain goats.
Any mountain goats on this one. Mm-hmm. You want to see... You go up to Grays and Torreys for anybody listening in Colorado. You can see mountain goats pretty quickly.
I like the mountain
quickly.
Goats, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So anyway, I headed up. I was moving pretty fast. I climbed. I got 4,000 feet, got to the summit of Mount Missouri in good time, about 6 miles in about 3.5 hours.
Wow.
But of course, just as I was about to get to the summit, there was an older gentleman, probably in his 60s, and his son, who would look to be in his 20s, they were just coming down. So as I'm coming up, they're coming down. And of course, and this is like the first... people that I've seen
coming down
on the trail at all. I passed a couple of people at you know when it was still dark, but it had been hours since I saw anybody.
Wow.
Right?
Huh.
So I give a big.
I've
hey!
Only been around because I'm slow.
Yeah,
I've only been around
people coming
crowds
down.
Crowds of people. No, yeah. Just like.
Oh, I see. Well, this
passing
was
passing me.
This was on a Friday.
I'm passing them.
This is a kind of a harder
like,
climb, so it's not
it's
one
like
of the most
a
popular 14ers.
Big. Yeah. Okay. That's, I've
think.
Never been around.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, just
it wasn't.
Slow.
It wasn't that crowded.
Wow.
At least Mount Missouri wasn't. Over on Belford, it got a little more crowded. But anyway, so I was excited. I stopped, and as I waved and said hello, I slipped. I fell flat on my face.
Oh my
I landed
gosh.
On my belly, and then I started kind of sliding down.
Oh,
it was a very,
no.
very steep pitch because it's right before the summit. It was like gravelly and dusty, and I'm sliding down. And I'm still looking up at these two people, kind of like it's like in a movie in slow motion. I'm looking up at them. I'm thinking like, help me! I gotta stop myself through basically sheer willpower. And I'm like, I know that's the first time I've fallen all day, friend. They just kind of look at me like, are you okay?
Did they try to help you or were?
Well, there's no
way to help.
There's
you.
No really. It's so steep and so. You know, gravelly and loose. It's like loose scree. So if it happened too quickly for them to be able to kind of stop. And
if you
they
hadn't
would have
been able to stop yourself, could it have been like really bad?
No, not
okay.
where I was.
Okay.
I mean, it was a long way down. It would have meant what I would have had probably taken a half an hour to climb back up to the point I was.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like a steep canyon.
That's a weird way to fall. Why did you slip?
I don't know.
Huh.
I don't know. But it was the first time I fell. But anyway, so then I go down about 1,500 feet and then had to climb straight back up 1,500 feet, got to the top of Belford. And then
the second 14er.
So that's the second 14er. And then you look over at Oxford. And now Oxford is the third 14er. I really wanted to bag three 14ers, cross them off the list. I'm not trying to climb all the 14ers. It would have just been nice since I was there. It's the only other way to get over to Oxford would be nice to get there. So at this point, I've done about 6,000 feet of climbing. I've been out on the trail about 5-6 hours. I'm exhausted, and I look over, and you can see the trail. The trail over to the top of Oxford, it's only 1.2 miles away to the peak.
Oh, but you can see the trail. 1.2.
The trail goes straight down a rocky ridge and then goes straight back up to Oxford. So what that meant is I would have had to climb down,
all the way back
up,
down,
turn around, back down, and back up. And I sat there for about literally 5 minutes trying to will myself into doing it. And I like to say that I was afraid of storms coming in, but it was a crystal clear day, not a cloud in the sky.
They are hard to climb.
Didn't have, and it might have been something to do with the fact that I hadn't. Let's blame it on the fact that I didn't sleep the night before.
Yeah.
And
we'd also, was that the week we had the band kidnapping?
Yeah, that's right. It was.
It was a week of no sleep. Yeah.
And, you know, I was kind of, my mountain legs weren't under me. I hadn't been doing a lot of mountain climbing recently, so.
Listen, you told me you were going to do two, so I didn't.
That's true.
Like, when you called me, because there's cell service on the top of the 14ers, and you're like, hey, I see that one. I'm not going
to
do it.
Yeah. I pretty much resigned myself to it. I felt good about getting two in.
You should feel good. Yeah.
But the last interesting thing that happened is that as I was coming down off of Belford, going down a very steep pitch, and it kind of like zigzags down short switchbacks. I was coming down pretty fast. There was a couple ahead of me who stopped, got to the side to let me go. And once again, I fell down, and as I'm falling, I feel myself heading straight for the guy who's gotten off the trail.
Oh.
He's looking at me with his huge saucer eyes. I'm flailing, trying to stop myself, kind of kicking, trying to look for something to grab onto as I feel myself plummet. I'm heading straight towards him. And luckily, at the last second, I found a large rock to kind of break myself with, with my foot, to stop myself from falling. But once again, and immediately I shout, why do I always fall when someone is standing right there?
I would not have believed you would have been
like, hey. They stared at me and they just gave me an awkward, okay, buddy.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
Because you lose your focus.
Yeah, maybe that's it. You know what? You're absolutely right. There's other people there. You want to say hello and you lose your focus. And
that's
if
right.
you don't have your focus with every, you know, foot plant, that's exactly what happens.
Also,
nice
you're
job.
Tired. You're mm-hmm. tired, too.
Yeah, and you're tired.
It's fatiguing, and there's not tired. Enough oxygen.
Yep. So I just, I scuttled down as fast as I could so they couldn't say anything.
The second one is really embarrassing because, like, yeah, you could have taken them out.
Could have taken them out.
I don't know. The first one's pretty embarrassing, too, because all you did was lift your hand for a wave.
Yeah. And so, you know, I will say I've made an attempt to climb a 14er. And we made it to like 13,000, you know, I don't know, 800 feet. Like it was the last couple hundred feet, which was the steepest.
Mm-hmm. It's always the steepest, right, by the end.
And, you know, and basically there were storms. We could see storms. So it got, it was so late, it was like, yeah, there's no point. But the other thing is, with the altitude that high, well, basically I would stop until my heart would stop racing.
Mm-hmm. Your heart beats loudly and
it's
rapidly.
Wild. It's absolutely wild. Yeah.
And so this got to the point where my heart was probably, you know, up close to 200 beats a minute.
Mm.
Right? And even resting wasn't helping it at all.
Yeah.
And so that's when I decided, you know, that's it. There's no point with, you know, late in the afternoon, but it's just how difficult it is. And Dave's in phenomenal cardiovascular shape. But, you know, what did your heart rate reach?
Well, I had my Apple Watch with me, and I did have my heart rate monitor on, so I was checking that out. And usually, if it got up to, when it got up to 170, I would stop and let it come back down, and it might have gotten up to 170, but it would hit up into the 160s, and that's when I knew I would kind of stop, let it go back down into the 130s, 140s, and keep going. So
I've done four 14ers.
Oh, four. Okay.
And I don't know. I don't know that I would necessarily ever need to do another one, to be perfectly honest with you.
Well, it's nice because you can... It's
nice up there.
The views are phenomenal up there. But absolutely amazing.
It's hard. It's hard to get up there.
It's incredibly and hard.
It's like the early morning. There's other hikes that I probably like better in terms of the views and the way they look. I like wildflower hikes. Mm-hmm. Wildfire. Definitely don't like wildfire hikes. I like wildflower hikes. Yes. I like the streams. I like that type of alpine scenery. Yeah.
And there were some beautiful...
Because once you get up to the top there, it's just rocks.
At the top is just rocks. And at that point, you're in it for the view, which is beautiful. Yeah. And I'll put up some pictures on the website, theinsideflap.com. I did see some beautiful fields of wildflowers and some phenomenal views. So go ahead and check that out. And if you do get a chance to climb one, when you come out to Colorado, there are some easy ones. You can check it out.
They're not easy. He says this. Here to tell you, okay, it's nothing I would ever call easy.
You're right. I don't know why I said
they're
easy.
They're all hard.
There are some easier
there you go.
Than others.
Yes.
And always give yourself a couple days to acclimate to the elevation.
And just know, after 10,000, you're going to have a little trouble breathing.
You're going to struggle.
You
take breaks. You get up, you get early, and you take breaks.
Yeah.
Anyway, Laura, how has your week been?
It's been pretty good. I have two different stories. So the first one, we just had a gas line run from our old house to the addition for a fireplace.
Yes.
And I had the inspector come out, I guess Monday, doesn't matter, but like yesterday.
Yeah, and so, I kept waiting for one of these guys to have a French accent and call himself Inspector Clouseau. Still waiting for that.
We get the same guy all the time.
The guy, the Wisconsin guy, right?
The same exact guy every time, even though he's really just the plumbing inspector. But they had let go some other inspectors that weren't doing great.
Right.
And then this time they'd hired other ones, but he said they were all on vacation, so it's just him. I mean, he maybe doesn't even work for the city of Littleton, and he just shows up. Like, it's one of those, like, you again.
That's who we want.
Like, he knows our cat. He knows the dogs.
Yeah.
So he, the cat, he likes the cat for whatever reason. This cat's a holy terror. Hmm. He likes the cat. He talks a lot about the cat every time he's here. Oh, you don't need to bother about the cat. I love cats. Yeah. My wife and I, we love cats. So,
unlike someone I know.
Andrew!
And someone else.
Yeah, hello?
My dad.
Yeah. And my friend Joyce as well.
Oh, let's put Joyce in that list of mortal enemies to our cat, Honey.
Yeah. So we have a crawl space in the new addition that he needed to get down to look to see how the gas line looked, to check it out.
Yes.
So I pried it open because we still don't have a handle on the thing.
It was a very heavy.
Very heavy. I'm sweating. I'm cursing Dave's name under it because I'd hoped he would have helped me. But both of us forgot that, of course, the inspector's got to get down there to look. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I grab a ladder. I get the ladder down there. Well, the next thing, so I know this cat, our cat jumps down into the dark crawl space. And I forgot there's a light down there that I could have turned on for the inspector.
Oh, yeah, you could have. That would have been
nice. Completely forgot. And he just has his phone as a flashlight, which is fine. But I forgot. And I'm just now remembering that.
That's right. Yeah.
So I don't know that he saw the cat jump down there.
Okay.
And the inspector jumped down before I could get the ladder in, too.
All right.
So, like, imagine this. Like, I pry open the thing.
Yeah.
I realize, oh, I need to get a ladder. The cat jumps down into the dark. I turn, go to get a ladder. Then the inspector walks behind me, jumps down in the dark.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah. And the next thing I know, I hear shouting. I hear a hiss. I hear, the cat's down here with me. He's not very happy about it. He's like shouting. In the meantime, I haven't given either one of them a ladder to get themselves out.
No. Are you kidding me?
No, because I'm panicking because I'm trying to be nice to the inspector.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
you
Andrew.
You got to kiss the ass of the inspector always.
Now, this cat, I've been where this cat was. I was in a space where the cat didn't like me.
Yes.
Being.
That's right.
Yes.
And the cat will keep coming after you.
Yes.
Hissing. Yeah. Getting big. So it's not like the cat just sits there hissing at you.
He's aggressive.
It comes after you.
He's an aggressive animal.
He is.
And he did not like that the inspector was down there with him in the dark.
He gets very territorial.
In a boxed-in area. And the panic in his voice And he was shouting, carrying on, and then the cat's not happy about this. He's shouting at me. And then I did one of those like where I shake my hands up in the air because I'm like too agitated to even grab the ladder.
At that point, you can't function or do anything.
That's in front of me because I'm like, I don't know how to do this.
Yeah.
And so I do grab the ladder. I get it down there. I get the inspector up safely, I assume.
Did you grab his hand and pull him up, help him up?
I wanted to, but I didn't because he's a grown man.
That's true.
I wanted to, though. Far. The mom in me was like, let me help you up, son, because he is younger than me. But then I was like, no, don't do that. Don't do that, Laura. Don't.
He is a grown
don't
man.
Don't do that. Mm-hmm. So I didn't. And then he walks away. And I apologize for the cat. And he's like, no, it's okay. It's okay. But I could tell he was a little shaken up by that experience in the dark with the cat. And I hadn't turned the light on for him. We passed inspection. So
I'm surprised he passed us after all of that.
And then I was like, I wonder how the cat's going to get out. And then I walked back over while the inspector was doing something else.
Yeah.
And there's the cat just climbing up the ladder like a person.
Up the ladder.
So it was kind of funny.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. But no, I wanted to say, so school starts here. It starts for Sylvia.
Yes, it does.
Thursday. Yep. We're recording this on Tuesday. I think this is going to air Wednesday, maybe Thursday.
Yep.
But it starts this week in our district.
I have another week before I go back.
Doesn't start Friday or is it Thursday that it starts?
Sylvia starts Thursday. Yeah.
Okay.
Depending on the school.
It depends on the age.
Yeah, and our kids go back Friday, I think. Yeah.
Elementary, but Dash will probably go.
Middle school, but I think it's, and he actually had some sort of like intro thing today.
He would. They isolate the sixth graders before those mean old seventh and eighth graders can get in there.
He's a seventh grader now.
Oh, he's a seventh grader. Right. I wonder. Oh, they do a seventh grade thing, don't they?
Something, yeah, because they get lockers and stuff.
That's right.
Yeah,
I forget.
Each grade has their own day to come in, so they're not overwhelmed with all the kids in the building.
Yeah. But it's weird starting the school, and then you read the papers about this Delta variant. And then, like, she's, like, full-on in band camp that we've talked about before. And, like, there's all these competitions coming up and big things to do and lots of fun. But then in the back of my head, I'm like, I don't know if this is going to happen or not.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those things where I feel really excited about the school year.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm like, stepping back from it because I don't know. And I guess you could say the same of any school year that you start. You don't
but
know what's going to happen.
But even more so now. Like, we've already been
told. I'm aware that things can come to a crashing halt now. So now I feel like I can't enjoy stuff because I'm too busy, which is not a good way to go through life, really. No. But I feel like that is how I'm going through life right now.
Yeah.
And worrying about what's going to happen in the future. And it's something I can't even control.
And I know in Denver schools, we've already been informed that we are to wear masks, even all vaccinated, doesn't matter, wearing masks. Also, if you do know a teacher out there, what I would recommend, don't ask them. This is the time of year when people love to do this to me. The UPS guy hopped off his truck.
I hear it all the time. People ask you
this
all the time.
Did it to me the other day. Our friend Dave Thomas loves to do this. He will say this to me.
He does that because he knows
you hate it. He says this to me the day after, the first day of summer vacation. He'll call me up and say this to me. And that is this. Please, if you are not a teacher and you know one, do not say this to another teacher. And that is, when you go back, do not ask us. We're on summer vacation. Okay? Please, do not. The last thing we want to think of, and this is the time of year when it starts creeping into our thoughts. Oh, I have 3 days left, 2 days left, 1 day. We don't want to think about going back. Don't ask us.
Well, you know what, Dave?
What?
Suck it. Because the rest of us get like 2 weeks vacation a year.
I don't get any vacation.
You know? Okay. And like I said, I will say
zero paid vacation.
You know what? So live with it.
I will say the same thing to you that I say to anyone. Feel free to come into my classroom and teach my students.
Question,
any
though,
day you want. Yes.
Do you have the anxiety about your job in terms of, like, are we going to have to go remote? Like, does that enter into your thoughts at all?
A little bit. No, it's just more of the fact
it's
now.
It's mostly just wearing the mask.
That I got to, no. The anxiety is all of, it all comes from
school.
Report to duty.
Okay,
That's three words. Report to duty. Now, I can, if I don't want to get up at 7, I don't have to get up at 7. I'll get up at 8. I'll get up at 9. Maybe I'll get up at 10. God forbid I could sleep that long.
Oh, during summer?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, good luck with that.
I know. So, it's just all, you know, when you're away from something for so long that you are obligated to do, it's hard to go back.
Yeah, Well, how have you been, Andrew?
Good. You know, it's been busy because Summer's wrapping up. I mean, our three kids go back. Now, we just finished, or finishing spring cleaning in our house, and we've done the following. We basically, have gone through all the rooms and closets, getting stuff out of there. We are rearranging furniture where I moved my entire office down to the basement.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave got to see my office in the basement today.
I did. He's got himself a nice little office down there.
I bet he does. Tucked away.
It's got even got a door on there.
Yep.
That's good. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's in the old guest room, right?
It's in the old guest room.
Cool.
It's perfect size where everything's in there.
Who has your old office?
And so Mary Kate is moved in there. So
I bet she's happy.
We moved her in there. We're getting her furniture.
Because she was sharing with Peter.
And she was. And so now she just turned 7. Mm-hmm. She's getting to the point where she really wants her own room.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Her and Peter have got different ways of organizing things, just a little bit different.
It would be, I feel like it'd be pretty easy to share a room with Dashiell. I don't know Mary Kate well enough yet, but I feel like with her not so bad. I think it'd be very hard to share a room with Peter because of his animatronic love.
That's true.
As long as you don't mind climbing over piles of animatronics.
That's the thing.
I was over there today helping Andrew move some, and they also generously opened up his dumpster for me. So I could dump some stuff in there. Mm. But while I was there, the UPS guy came off the truck and delivered something for Pete Dowd. And Andrew picked it up. He goes, I see Peter's got another animatronic.
Pete.
Does he just get on Amazon himself and order stuff?
Pretty much. eBay, Amazon. I mean,
oh my God.
You know.
And he has it as Pete, not Peter?
I mean, who knows?
That's hilarious.
Yeah. Is Peter 10 now or 9? 10. He just turned 10, right?
10. Yeah. Yeah. And so it's like...
Yeah.
You know, I see $120 spent on my PayPal. I'm like, Peter! What is this?
Hmm.
And I wish that was an exaggeration. So, this monumental task. Part of...
That is a lot of work.
One of the final things is, in our house, about 4,000 square feet.
Mm.
I would say, 2,700 square feet of is carpet.
Hmm.
And so we had...
That's a lot with kids and pets.
Oh, we had the carpet guy come in.
I didn't realize. You're right, though. You have a lot.
Two dogs.
It's the basement.
Three cats.
Basements, and the bedrooms.
Two sets of stairs.
Three kids.
Yeah. And so Katie's like, well, we can't shampoo your office because where are we going to put the cats? I'm like, well, let's just put the cats in the bathroom. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so...
Yeah. While you shampoo it?
So we open the shower door and put the litter box in there and stuff like that.
Oh, you mean in the shower?
Well, no.
I understand now.
So anyway, I come home and then And Peter's got scratches all up and down his arms. He's like, well, the one cat was fine. The other cat was just absolutely psychotic.
Panicking.
So
our cat who got locked in the thing with the inspector.
It's like it took us 25 minutes to get the cats in there.
Oh.
Right? And shut the door.
Wow.
And so I come home around 3 and I hear the cats meowing in there constantly. They're like throwing themselves at the door.
Oh, my God.
Throwing themselves at the door. And so I figured... Boy, this is going to be interesting when we open that door.
Oh,
right?
No.
And so, of course, we finally open the door. And these cats are great, right? I mean, they're really friendly cats.
Uh-huh.
And
unlike ours.
Yeah. So we open the door, and they've taken kitty litter.
Strewn it all
over the bathroom.
I saw it today. It was something out of a Saw movie.
That's hilarious.
I mean, it was smeared on the wall.
That is so funny.
It was just crazy.
They went insane.
And these are... Yeah, and they were just... and so that's what happened. That's my...
Oh, that's really funny.
I couldn't believe it. I mean...
We've been locking our cat up.
Yeah,
but it's been in a bedroom.
With all the people coming and going, leaving the doors open and stuff.
And he's been fine, but... A bathroom might be different. It might feel different to them.
Those cats didn't want to have anything to do with it.
If it had a window, maybe it would have been different.
Yeah.
Like if we'd have put them in. But unfortunately, we were shampooing all the rooms, all the rooms with windows. Now, my other story is, of course, today I went for my annual physical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I will plug my insurance company. I've got this, work for a great big company. I am signed up for the Premier Insurance Plan, but they will not cover my annual physical.
What?
Yeah. And I've appealed it.
Really?
Yeah, and I've appealed it. And it just comes down to the thing is they want you to use, their in-plan doctors. Now, they still cover my doctor out of plan, but it's just one of those things is...
So it would be covered if you went to one of their docs?
Yeah, if I went to one of their doctors.
Well, that makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
But then
what are you fussing about, mister?
It works in American medicine.
Yeah. I've got the preferred plan, which allows me...
you should be able to pick your docs.
Yeah.
Oh, who's got the...
But anyways, it's just...
Preferred plan.
So a little...
I hear that.
A little plug there for the insurance companies, not even government. So today I go in there, You know, it's not, you know, and this is a full physical with eye test and poking and
that's
prodding.
Good for you.
EKG, all
Dave
that
and
stuff.
Dave needs to do it. I got to get mine. I
gotta get
put it
done.
Off from COVID. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, nothing I look forward to.
No.
And so we get it done. So anyway, so the last part of this is, is they have to, you know, draw blood.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I actually much prefer them drawing blood than getting a vaccine. Like I hate the vaccine needles.
I'd get vaccines all day long before I'd get my blood drawn. Yeah, I don't like getting my blood drawn.
And for me, it's
not that bad, but vaccines don't bother me.
So it's a new nurse in there. And for me, it's always the thing is this is the third nurse they've had in like 5 years.
Oh.
And so it's like, well, how good's this girl going to be? Woman, you know, with
you,
a blood draw.
You see, he corrected himself.
I didn't say it.
Nice job.
I wasn't even going to say it. I was just going to let you do it.
You get another round of applause for that one. Nice
job. Yeah. Bonus.
So, of course, you know, and when she's like, well, are you a difficult blood draw? I'm like,
they always ask that stuff. You know, and I'm like, I don't know. Are you difficult?
I'm like, well,
do you know how to stick a needle?
Not normally. And so anyways, she sticks me in the first arm.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, oh, I missed it. Oh, I chased it away or, you know, or something.
Like it jumped.
I don't know.
I've heard that before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then she's like, well, you know, let's try the other arm. And so, of course, then she sticks me in my like right hand.
Oh, that hurts.
Hand. Yeah. Where in
the
your hand?
The hand hurts.
Yeah, in the hand. And then she's like, oh, we missed that one too. Oh.
In the back of your hand?
Yeah,
that's where Sylvia had to have that when she had all those hives.
Yeah.
That's what they did at Children's Hospital.
And so that didn't work. She's like, well,
that's a painful one.
Let me call in the other nurse. And so basically, so then I got stuck in my left hand.
Oh.
And the thing is, I'm like, you know, it's okay. You know, I'm like, just don't start sticking needles in under my toes.
Now, do you start to have to talk to yourself of like breathing?
Because
at that point, I would have been,
yeah,
cortisol levels would be rising.
You know, like I said, if it was vaccine shots,
so
it'd be a different
weird.
Story. But these honestly don't bother me all that much.
Isn't that funny? Our individual little things.
Yeah. And so basically.
Like, I'm starting to get anxious listening to that.
The other woman comes in, she sticks me, but I literally have, like, a pink ribbon around my arm, I got a Band-Aid in my right hand, I come out of there looking half like a mummy.
With all the bandages.
You know?
Yeah.
You know,
that's a tough one. I know the worst needle I've ever had, whereas two, both related to oral surgery. One is when, a couple times, I've had the dentist, took the needle, and if you open your mouth right now, I want you to put your finger on the roof of your mouth, right where your palate is. Imagine the sharpest, longest needle point right to the center, the top center of the, right at the palate of the upper part of your mouth, and jammed the needle in that. That was incredibly painful. The other one was where the guy was getting ready to give me a needle at like the lower right, kind of like a fatty, meaty part of my
jaw,
the inside of my jaw there. And he said, once I depress this needle, you're going to feel, it's going to go past a nerve area, and you're going to feel an electric shock.
Whoa.
And I'm like, yeah, all right, whatever, buddy. Sure, whatever. Just give me the shot. Thinking, that's impossible. It's not going to feel electric. But sure enough, he jabbed it in there, and as he depressed it, it literally felt like I stuck my tongue in the electrical outlet. It was like a kind of sound. It was it was the weirdest thing I'd ever heard of.
Wow. I don't have any even the epidural that I got was not bad, because I couldn't see it. It was in my back. I had no idea.
Yeah. So
that was it, an epidural? Whatever it is that they give you.
I'm going to brush my teeth extra good tonight.
Yeah, make sure you.
Yeah, because it's the mouth stuff that is stressful to think about for me. That stresses me out. Then I get very stressed. I don't even like to get my teeth cleaned, and now you have to get them every 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
I feel incredible stress leading up to it. I hate that.
I've got dental floss in the car. I was actually flossing my teeth on the way over.
You? How come?
What? Just
because?
Was eating some spare ribs for dinner.
Oh.
And
ladies, are you listening?
You know.
All right, let's move on from that. We got a special guest for you today, Edgar Award-winning author Megan Abbott. Her new novel is titled The Turnout. And Laura, why don't you tell us a little bit about this book before we play you our conversation with Megan Abbott?
So this is an elegantly written, very dark tale of the Durant sisters, Marie and Dara, who run a ballet studio. Dara is married to another dancer, Charlie, who grew up with them in their childhood home that they all still live in. So a little incestuous. Mm-hmm. This is an insular, darkly elegant, painful world. This world of ballet, and then the world that Marie, Dara, and Charlie inhabit. Like unbelievable in terms of the pain that dancers go through.
Yeah.
So they are preparing for their annual Nutcracker show. They have a contractor in who's repairing the studio after a fire, strange fire. They have drama with parents, drama with their contractor, who you'll hear coming up that Megan Abbott compares him to Stanley in Streetcar Named Desire, which I wished I'd thought of when I was reading it because he kept reminding me of somebody.
I wish I'd had
Stanley in my head.
You blew that.
Who's the guy that played Stanley? Now, why can't I remember
Marlon
his name?
Marlon Brando.
Man, my friend Renata and I, shout out to Renata, we watched that on VCR, and neither one of us had ever seen anything like Marlon Brando.
No,
the young Marlon Brando, the charisma that oozed out of him was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. So this book is a noir. It's set within the kind of just unsettling, painful world of ballet. And if you've ever watched The Black Swan, you'll know what I mean a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So Black Swan.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. I said The Black Swan.
No article.
I've actually never seen Black Swan.
Really?
No.
Oh, it's good.
Yeah.
Dark.
I know. That's why I honestly don't want to watch Black Swan.
No, you don't want to see it.
I really don't.
It's hard. I couldn't watch it again, I don't think.
I'm good with not watching it. So this is very elegant writing. This is dark. It's twisted. There's female power, sexuality, shame. And this is disturbing in the very best way.
Oh.
You know, Abbott is a superb writer.
I think she
just keeps getting better and better at her craft. And this will unsettle you.
She's an up-and-comer. I'm looking for big things coming out of her.
She is not an up-and-comer, man. She is established.
She's arrived. She's there. Yeah.
And she's there.
We had a great talk with her, too. So,
Just roll with it. So, listen, you guys know me. I read cozies. I love cozies. I could handle this. It's unsettling.
Right.
You just got to roll with it and know that's what it is. The writing is so good.
All right, cool. Let's take a listen now to our conversation with Megan Abbott. Dilda Dawn, what's that flower you have on? Could it be a faded rose from days gone by? And did I hear you say he was meeting you here today to take you to his mansion? Man, I loved your book, The Turnout. Dark, twisted story. So dark, so twisted.
So elegant, though. Like a young Miss Havisham elegance. About the Durant sisters who run a ballet studio with one of their sister's husbands, Charlie. It's just an insular world of mangled bodies and feet, satin slippers, cigarettes.
Ooh.
Cigarettes, Dave.
Sure.
Shame.
Lots of cigarettes.
Shame and desire.
What a heady mix.
Well put.
Well, it's your words, kind of. What inspired you to write this book?
I always wanted to set something in ballet, sort of for all those reasons. It's sort of the glamour and the toll, the sort of light and dark, and but I didn't really have a story. And then I started to become interested in this idea of these sisters. Because when I first took ballet. I took a couple years as a kid, and the school I went to was run by two twin sisters in that case, and we were all fascinated by that.
I bet.
They seemed so glamorous and. We were always speculating, were they rivals? Were they jealous of each other? What were their love lives like? And so I started to think about the sisters that then became the sisters of the Turnout. So it sort of flowed from there.
Wow. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine. Were they elegant? Like the women that you trained with, were they elegant and like the long necks and all that?
Exactly. Yeah. They were so, just had this serenity, it seemed, to them. You know, they were so graceful. It's sort of the opposite of the sort of awkward, sweaty kid I was in class. Like, I'm supposed to become that? How is that going to happen? Impossible.
That's really funny. The mangled feet, like the satin toe shoes. I didn't realize that they like hammered and shaped that cardboard. And I also didn't realize that the shoes didn't last. Like, they'd have to do that frequently. And then I probably shouldn't have been surprised, but like the razor blades that like would be sneaked into the toe shoes. How did you go about doing research for the book? Because all those little details really added a lot.
I'm so glad. I was sort of fascinated by all that. I sort of followed my fascination. I would read something I was reading a lot of ballet memoirs and then sort of nonfiction books about the Nutcracker and watching documentaries. But the best stuff was really the inside stuff. A lot of it was on YouTube. I mean, there's thousands of videos of dancers preparing their point shoes and breaking them down. And they all have different technique and they all have different tools they use. And some would never use a hammer and some you will only use a special kind of hammer. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to make it like a second skin, right?
Yeah.
And they all have different ways for getting there. So all of that was fantastic. And then some of the stuff about the sort of rivalries and, sneaking razor blades and shoes, that was funny because I kept reading about how everyone says, no one really does that. And then other people would say, well, they did, but they did at my school. And so it's a controversial topic among ballet dancers. And no one really wants to admit that ever happened, but it seems like everyone has a story of it happening once. And that's when you know.
Man. And now how much of a method writer are you? Are you grabbing ballet shoes and strapping them on and trying to test them out?
Oh, did you buy any?
Did you get into it?
I did buy a pair. I bought a used pair. I'm probably the only person not buying it for very odd purposes, but I did buy them because I really wanted to see what they had liked when they had been worn. They prepared and worn.
Yeah.
I did have a dancer who, when the manuscript was finished, I asked her to run a fact check on it for me, and she was very helpful. But I really, before I gave it to her, my goal was to have as few mistakes as possible. So I really, I'm a method that way. Not unfortunately in developing any grace or skill.
But, that takes more time.
That comes at a huge cost, though. Yeah. That comes at a cost.
I think so.
Yeah.
Where does one find a good used pair of ballet sleep shoes these days? Are we talking Craigslist? Are you wandering around thrift stores?
There's a corner shop that's in the back room. It's really all on eBay, I have to tell you.
eBay.
This is the magic of our current internet age, is that now I've destroyed my search engine. My search history is for Google is forever recorded, but there people really do buy them and for whatever purpose. But my purpose was that I really wanted to hold them and see,
and smell them.
Smell them. You got to smell them. Did they have a nice aroma?
It's true. These mostly smelled like being put through the U.S. mail.
That's too bad.
But the smells were a big part of it for me because so many in the memoirs that came up a lot about how specific the smell was. All those bodies in that close space and how intimate it is. And how you have to sort of like any sort of it's like any sport too, you sort of become like you can't even smell it because you're in it all the time.
That's really interesting because that is something I really noticed about this book. A lot of writers I don't think pay attention to smell, and you used it so much that it made the story more vivid for me. So you have the tiger balm, the musk of feet. And I actually have a line that I really liked that I'm going to quote back to you, Megan Abbott. quote, in every carpet fiber, every pine whorl, their mother's scent, perfume and desperation. And that is
that's
perfect.
Good. That's good.
I just loved that so much.
Oh, I'm so glad. I was definitely reading a lot of Tennessee Williams.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. That might be it. There's a certain, I did sort of want to have that, because he does write about women like this.
Yes, he does. Oh, my God.
the contractor in the novel has a little bit of a Stanley energy.
Darn it. That's what it was. I kept thinking of, I don't know why, but it was like a Saul Bellow, the Rain King. I kept thinking of that character, Henderson maybe, and then, but I should have thought of Stanley, and I don't know why I didn't.
Stella!
Darn it.
Stella!
Yeah.
Do you like, you got a good Stella in you?
Oh my gosh. I have too much of a Minnie Mouse voice to pull that off. But it is my dream one day.
You really got to get down into the soul to hit a good Stella.
Yeah. I still remember where I was when I first saw that movie.
Really?
Oh, knocked my socks off. Yeah.
Yeah, that's such a go-to because it is so much. I mean, most of crime fiction is about that kind of primal desires, you know, it's like lust, envy, greed, you know, all these sort of, you know, it's all the sort of deadly sins. And that's certainly something that Tennessee Williams wrote about. But I think the reason sort of we can point to other people have talked about Shirley Jackson, and We Have Always Lived in the Castle and some other stuff. Yeah. And I think it's because these are really primal ideas and, you know, it's books like fairy tales. They're always returning to these things because we can all identify. We've all felt all those things.
Yeah.
For sure. And speaking of deadly sins, how many times did you watch the different versions of the Nutcracker? Did you find any like really bad versions of it?
Oh boy. Yeah. I mean, you can find it. Yeah. You can, because you can find lots of, you know, very hardworking little local dancers.
Oh yeah.
With the kid. I mean, because it's really hard ballet today. I mean, there's lots of small, the reason I think it's been such a holiday classic, and there's so many small parts for aspiring dancers that you can sort of tuck them all in as party guests or mice.
They're little mice. That's true. Yeah.
The mice.
And, you know, very few make it to Clara or the Sugar Plum Fairy. But it was really interesting how that sort of, that story is just sort of twisted and turned. You know, the original one is, the story is sort of very, very dark and very Freudian and very spooky, and that it became this Hollywood classic. But I think there's still sort of a dark undercurrent, like there isn't any fairy tale. And I think it sort of sneaks in somehow. There's a little bit of an ominous feeling. You know, that the Clara, the little girl, goes into this sort of, she dreams herself into this sort of paradise of adulthood. But she never actually, we never know what happens to her after. It just kind of ends, which is sort of eerie in its own way. So like all fairy tales, when you really look at them, you think, why did I give my children this?
Exactly.
Once
you start doing a deeper reading of it and it's really dark. Start thinking about it.
It's so dark, but then children are able to handle that really well.
I think they respond to it, right? That's why when you're a kid, you always, it's like you're always wanting to read about orphans too. You know how many children's books are about orphans?
That's bizarre.
Like everyone has fantasies of killing their parents.
I know. And I read a lot of mysteries, and it's always the single woman. Maybe her husband died, or maybe we don't know what happened to him, but it's always the single woman.
That's like, it's
like female fantasy mysteries.
Wait, knock off the husband.
Yeah. So, Dara, do you say Dara or Dara?
I say Dara.
Dara.
But yeah, just in my head.
Yeah.
It feels like Dara, you know, giving her elegance.
Yeah, that's true.
It does sound nice.
They're so defined in my head, and I imagine they're really well defined in your head. But there are people, too, that I can't imagine them going into a brightly lit Target or a Walmart, like, ever. And I don't know that there's that many women that are like this that much anymore out there. And I wondered if when you created them, how real they felt to you, and if you kind of like looked for like glimpses of that woman, that archetype, almost like you said, like the Tennessee Williams archetype. Did you look for those a little bit in real life now? And do you think are they out there? I feel like it's fading.
I guess it's sort of, you know, in our sort of way we live now in social media, it feels like that kind of glamour or mystique is more unattainable.
Yeah.
But, you know, so maybe that's why it feels more exotic. But I think it still lurks. It's sort of the mystery of a person who lives their life so differently than you. And the sort of, it even goes back to when you're a kid, you would run into your teacher at the drugstore, and you didn't think that they existed in the real world and that they could have a family and all those things. And I think social media has sort of collapsed that. But I think it that I think there's still a long, maybe it's a longing we have for that, to sort of this notion of, because they sort of exist out of time,
yes,
Charlie, but they've never, they're sort of arrested, and it was one of the reasons that, you know, they have a landline. There's never any texting, really.
No.
You know, I really tried to keep that out.
Yeah.
So that it would have that eternal quality, which maybe, yeah, especially in the last year and a half has seems especially rare and special.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
It is. And now, you know, you can't have... You can't just, it goes beyond that, because now it's not even, you know, chatting, you're texting with someone, now you got to Snapchat them, or now you got to find 15 other apps where you have to communicate
with
someone else.
There's a face, and it's an awkward face when you hold it, like your cheeks look really big, or at least mine do.
Yeah.
You're like, do I look like that? I don't think I do. Maybe I do. Yeah.
It's now, true, and it's that blurring of the public and the private now that's so murky.
It is, yeah. It's not glamorous at all.
No.
Well, speaking of glamorous, you do have a lot of glamorous cigarette smoking. You know, I used to, I remember when I was teaching in New York City, I was talking to a woman, she used to be a dancer, and she said that a lot of dancers smoke, and I guess it was a way, where she was telling me, a way to kind of curb their appetite and to help, you know, maintain their weight. Did you incorporate a lot of cigarette smoking because of that? Do you smoke? Have you ever smoked? Did it make you want to smoke? I really wanted a cigarette.
And I looked up how to pronounce Galois. Before I talked to you.
Oh, yes. It had to be French cigarettes, of course.
Yeah.
I have never smoked, but as a lover of film noir, I appreciate as a physical prop, talk about a glamour that doesn't exist anymore, because now we can't think of smoking that way anymore, but I did have the perfect excuse that dancers often do smoke,
right,
for those reasons, and for the stimulant, you know, to sort of go back in. And also I do think they do still live, they're still apart from us in many ways.
Yes.
I live, you know, in New York, whenever I'm up by Lincoln Center in Juilliard, I always see dancers smoking.
I know.
I think it's a great excuse to not offend anybody by sort of just sort of shoving cigarettes in there so they look cool, but it really is true for dancers.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
They're the last bastion of the great American smoker.
But they're so elegant when they do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And just even the way they crush it out with their foot, it's different than...
Yep.
Yeah.
Now, listen, Megan Abbott, you were a showrunner, writer, and executive producer on Dare Me, you know, based upon your novel. Tell me a little bit about that experience. How exciting was that for you? Was that a lot of work?
It seems like a lot of work.
I mean, obviously, it's a lot of work, of course.
No, but I really had no idea how much.
Oh!
It really tells you. It's such a funny, you know, showrunner is such a mysterious title.
It is, what
that really means, and you sort of don't know it until you're doing it. But it was very consuming. It was sort of thrilling, because that had been in development since 2012.
Wow.
So it was like 7 years of development, and you know, most stuff doesn't get made. So
right.
I had accepted that it might not, but it did, and we made it. I guess the best part is that novel writing is so solitary, TV is so collaborative, and there's the part that's hard about it being collaborative, which is you have a lot of people giving you notes all the time. The good part is that if you go into production, if you're lucky enough to get a series order and you go into production, you have all these talented directors and actors and cinematographers and, you know, lighting and costume, and they all want to make this come to life, and they all bring their own ideas, and you're all kind of in it together in the foxhole, and you're really not alone. You're the opposite of alone. You're with this enormous team of people that are like great at their job and know stuff that you will never know. So, you know, the extent of care that the prop master would give to every prop that you would see on the show. We have a long conversation about the backpack and the you know, the sort of water bottle and all these sort of details that are sort of wallpaper when you watch it, but they do have an effect. They have a cumulative effect. So
yeah,
that was a great part of it. Really rewarding.
That's cool. Wow. I'm sure it's great to see so many people with so much, you know, pouring so much heart and soul into it. And then you probably get a note from the studio or from the network saying, can we make this character a man? Can we give him a mustache?
Yeah. Or do they have to be smoking in this scene?
We can't have people smoke. Come on.
Like, that's really funny.
Like someone can be a murderer, but you can't have them smoke.
Right.
That's so
exactly,
true.
Yeah.
They can be a terrible person.
You'd be a pedophile, for goodness sakes.
God forbid.
Add another one in there. Yeah. But no, we can't have them smoke. No, for God's sakes. So speaking of collaboration, though, how exciting for you was it must have been to be invited by David Simon to write alongside George Pelicanos and Richard Price? Good God. How,
I mean, that,
for
boy,
the deuce?
Talk about a murderer's row. That was that first day that I went into the writer's room, I like walked around the block like 16 times before I could go into the building. I'm like, oh no, these are like writing heroes here. And I'm going to stumble in here and come up with ideas. I mean, I guess the lucky part is that, you know, the show is about prostitution and pornography, so they really did need women in there. So,
yes.
I needed that I was would be a bit, you know, that they would listen to me, and they really did, and they made it so comfortable. But it still was like a really sort of had to bring out my inner hotspot every day.
I bet.
Every day to hold my own in that. Be intimidated by those very intimidating men.
I mean, those guys are incredibly intimidating.
I can't imagine. I mean, did like you let David Simon go to voicemail at first, or did you like pick up the phone?
Who is this really?
Did you be like, hey, David?
Well, they all sort of speak in these like long paragraphs that are so beautifully crafted, and it's like, and I'm saying, I don't know, you know, I think they should be smoking in this scene. it really was where I sort of just. You know, Lisa Lutz was the other female crime writer who was on the show. It was sort of our mission to just keep pitching for the female characters. And then so it sort of was, and they were very open to it, but it was great to sort of know that they knew they needed that. And we could just sort of be doing that all the time and just sort of be this broken record about, what about the women?
holding up little signs. Don't forget the women.
Exactly.
That's
so
awesome.
It was great, and I'm working on another project with George Pelicanos now. Ooh. So I didn't humiliate myself. So he continues to be willing to work with
me. He asked you back. Oh, that's awesome. That's great.
Of course he did.
Yeah, come on, Megan.
You're a star. You're a star.
Come on.
That's really funny. As an aside, we're huge The Wire fans of David Simon. And we started, we lived in Baltimore for a while and loved Homicide also. I was also curious, did writing television change the way you think about, you know, your place, your setting, your character description? Because your book was really vivid. The creaking, watery, dripping dance studio was just incredibly vivid for me.
I'm so glad. I really try not to think about that. Like, I really try to turn off that part of my brain because it is so different. And my biggest fear would be that a novel that would be like a treatment for a movie or TV show. And I don't really enjoy those novels. And I want it to be very interior. It's sort of one of the things you get to do in novels that you can't do in TV is really get in the head of the person reading it. So my goal always is to just completely turn that off. And but then I sort of become my own worst enemy, because then when I have to adapt it, I have to think, how am I going to turn this really internal thing into something visual? But I think keeping those separate feels really important.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
for sure. Do you have any kind of, when you're writing a novel, do you have any like interesting writing quirks that you always employ when you write?
Yes. Oh my God. An embarrassing
oh,
array.
Good.
I have, like, very superstitious. I have this like all these little tchotchkes on the shelf above my computer, and they sort of change based on the book. I had a little nutcracker up there for a while.
Cool.
Yeah. It's really weird. And
no, it's wonderful.
It's not weird.
I don't think it's weird.
No, we don't think
it's
weird.
Okay, good.
No.
I have songs that, you know, I used to not be able to listen to music when I write, but now we all have such cluttered brains anyway. It doesn't affect me the same way. And so I'll have songs that I'll listen to over and over again when I'm writing. And really, really immersive. I'll have photographs that I'll look at to get started in the morning. And it's really like almost casting a spell. It's sort of desperate, out of desperation. You know, I used to just sit down and write. And now I need all this stuff. But anyways, you know, the world has gotten a lot noisier since 2005 when I started doing this. So
that's true.
It's a lot to shut out. So I have to do all these steps. It's almost like I'm a witch.
Like a ritual. Yeah. Lighting candles, casting spells. What kind of music do you listen to?
It changes for each book. It's a sort of, I just had to do this playlist for the turnout that I posted for the Read with Jenna Club, is because it was like an odd.
Yeah, congratulations on that.
Oh,
that
thank
so
you.
So awesome. How excited. That is so great.
Wild. It was
so
wild.
Cool. Yeah.
It's like, yeah, you really don't, especially when you write dark books, you don't imagine.
No, yeah, you wouldn't think, right?
No, I guess the world has gotten a little more open to darkness, it is like a weird mix. You know, I had, of course, the Nutcracker on there, but also some, you know, some sort of Julian Baker, sort of like indie darling stuff, or people like Liz Fair, who, you know,
awesome.
Yeah, we love to kick out some of that. So it's really about mood and atmosphere more than lyrics or genre.
Yeah.
And then when I've done it, like, I can't listen to any of those songs.
I totally get that.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. There are certain times in my life where I'll listen to something obsessively over and over again, and then I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm done.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, Megan, it is time for our segment we call Quick Six, Six Quick Questions, which we find out just a little bit more about you. Here we go. What is the last show you watched or binged and really enjoyed?
Oh, White Lotus, which is one episode done to being finished. It's on HBO now.
Okay.
It's this sort of dark comedy created by Mike White. It's great.
Oh, White, yeah.
Yeah, so this is his new one, and it's sort of great cast of Jennifer Coolidge, all these great people, but they're sort of rich people in Hawaii at this resort, and the people who have to service them at the hotel, at the resort, and it's very sort of dark and great. I love it.
That's
highly
awesome.
Recommend.
That's great. Good one. Thanks for that one. Wow, I have to look for that.
Yeah, what fictional world or place would you like to visit, and if it's dangerous, we will let you back in.
I'm really interested in the world of horseback riding. A couple people tried to sell me that for a book setting, and I have gotten really interested in that.
Oh.
I was not a horse girl, but I've always been fascinated by the girls that were. So.
Ew, what was that? Yeah, because I read your gymnastics book and the ballet book. Now I'm like, you know, putting them down into like a little thing, and I know they're much bigger than that. But those worlds are, in a way, like similar with that obsession
definitely.
Yeah, awesome.
Almost cultish in some
yes.
ways.
Yeah.
How about this, Megan Abbott? Can you give us one of your top five favorite movies of all time?
Oh, yes. Raging Bull.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's really, you know, Raging Bull is very inspired by The Red Shoes, which is a ballet movie, weirdly, but Scorsese.
I didn't know that.
Out of it. It's a movie about artistic obsession.
Yeah.
And Raging Bull is about this sort of boxer, sort of self-destructive boxer. And he took a lot of the boxing in the ring moves from The Red Shoes about the ballet, how the ballet was shot. So it does have a connection, but I love Scorsese and
Raging
Bull. That's
so cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
I love that movie. We never gotten that answer from you. Bothered me about a steak. You bothered me about a steak. Oh my God. With Pesci, De Niro. I'm going to have to watch that one again tonight.
One of your favorites.
God, I love that movie. Yeah.
Oh.
Now, when they go miniature golfing, oh my God, he's down on the ground looking for the ball, and then they just walk away. Oh, how good is that?
Yeah. It can't be beat.
No.
I agree.
Good God.
Well, that's really funny. Yeah, that was one of the first movies you showed me, like a date movie.
Oh, that's when you knew. Get out while you can.
You should have run away then. Good God.
I should have. Just got in deeper. This might be a little more difficult. How about a top five favorite book?
Oh, you know, one that I certainly keeps coming up for me is we have always lived in the castle, Shirley Jackson, and some people have pointed out similarities with this book, and it probably unconsciously is in there. But most people know Shirley Jackson because of The Lottery, only you know, that's something they read in school. But her novels, like The Haunting of Hill House, is quite extraordinary. And We Have Always Lived in the Castle is about a very insular family with some pretty dark secrets. And that one is one I always return to. It's got a great voice, and you sort of can't put it down. So that would be one that maybe not everyone has come upon. That's a really dark and wonderful read.
That's good.
Yeah, and I think that TV show is also, I think, or I hope anyway, has brought a more of an audience to Shirley Jackson with The Haunting of Hill House, which was a good show. We enjoyed watching that one.
Yeah, the book was amazing, though. Yeah. Yes, I mean, I read that as a teenager, and it blew me away. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, completely agree.
How about this? Megan, do you have a go-to karaoke song?
Oh, Delta Dawn.
She does. Wow. I didn't know if you would.
Really?
Yes. I mean, I would say Jolene because that, but that's, I like to go a little more obscure. Delta Dawn, that everyone knows. And it's, you know, it's great torture, but it's not too long. So people always make the mistake of picking the long song.
That's good. Yeah.
Yes. And they don't realize how long the song is until
That's right. Until it bites them. Delta Dawn's tight and hot.
That's awesome.
That's good. You get up, you slay, and you get down. That's the way to do it.
Yeah. That's what Abbott does.
Smart. I get up there and say, give me American Pie. Then you're like the third chorus, you're like, Jesus, when is this song over? What's going on? It's four verses, that's five really verses. Come on!
I did that with a Katy Perry song once. And I was like, "Oh, I didn't know. I didn't realize it was like this." Last but not least, what book are you currently reading?
Oh, I'm reading The Moonlight Out by William Boyle. So he's a great writer.
Oh yeah,
if you know him. He's a Pegasus books. They're great New York set, mostly Brooklyn set, crime melodramas, I consider them. They're very much about family, and they're sort of sweeping, very Richard Price-like.
They are.
He's a big William Boyle fan.
I read all his stuff. I love him so much. When I read his last one, I had to contact him and to ask him to come on the show.
He was kind enough to come on. Yes, he's one of my dearest friends.
What? Really?
I see him. I was just down in Oxford visiting him and a few more friends down there. Oh, but he's the best. So that's cool. So nice.
Yeah, his writing, Jesus, it really spoke to me. He is damn good. And hopefully he gets more and more. I think he's getting more and more recognition. So
it's building.
That's cool.
Well,
all right, Megan, we love the book, The Turnout. Love chatting with you. Yeah. Thanks so much for
coming on. It's an honor to talk
to
you.
I've
been a fan of yours for a while.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Thank you.
I can't wait to share it. So I'll definitely share widely and look forward to another time.
That's awesome.
Sounds great.
Okay. Anytime.
The Inside Flap.
All right. Thanks so much to Megan Abbott. Mm-hmm. You know, every time I think about the Nutcracker now, I am taken back to when I was at Knoll Community Art School and Paige was the dance teacher there and they did the Nutcracker.
Oh, did they really?
And every single... So I like built all kinds of props for it.
Oh, man.
And it was like every single day she came back with, oh, yeah, Dave, can you also do this? And can you do this? And can you... Oh, like, Paige, come on.
Oh, man. The subtext that is in the Nutcracker that Megan Abbott dives into is startling to me. I had never thought of it that way. I'm not a big Nutcracker fan. I'm not a fan of the ballet.
I was never a fan of that. No.
But nothing against it either. I'm just, it's not for me.
Nope, I'll tell you what is for you. Libraries opening up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some
book reviews.
And let's start with
Laura Medicus.
Laura, what do you have for us this week?
So, when you read a Megan Abbott book.
Yes.
Dark.
Dark
world.
It's a dark and stormy night.
Elegant world of Megan Abbott.
Yeah, I think I've got a...
If you're Laura Medicus.
I've got audio from what you might hear... What is it?
If you're Laura Medicus, you will pair this with a cozy.
Oh, sure you will.
Yeah, because I cannot read Megan Abbott books at night right before I go to bed because I am fearful, Dave, of my dreams.
You're going to have bad dreams.
Right before I go to bed.
You got to.
So I'll read the book at night, right? I have no problems reading at night, but then, you know, the 15 minutes before I go to bed is crucial reading time for me also.
Uh-huh.
And I filled my brain with a cozy, and I filled it with a book called A Killer Plot by Ellery Adams. Oh. So this is the opposite of Megan Adams' books. This is a cozy mystery. I've had this book on my list to read for a while. I have been waiting for this because I like to read on my Kindle, so I've been in line with this book forever.
Been queued up.
Mm-hmm. Ellery Adams is a prolific cozy writer. She's written at least 40 books.
Yeah, I have. I am familiar with her.
Mm-hmm. She has, I think, at least 4 different cozy series out there, possibly 5. I've heard great reviews of this series. It's a Books by the Bay mystery series. And this book, A Killer Plot, is the very first one. Ah. And I love reading first in a series of cozies.
Now, Books by the Bay, I'm going to guess San Francisco Bay.
Oh, that's a good guess. In fact, because it had the word bay, I was thinking, and it has a lighthouse on the cover. Uh-huh. I kept thinking New England. This is set in North Carolina.
North Carolina.
So this has a traditional structure. There is a single middle-aged protagonist, female protagonist, with a poodle as a best friend. It's set in a town called Oyster Bay in North Carolina. Okay. And you know I love cozy world building.
Or as we say on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, Oyster Bay.
So this has cozy world. I really like this small town. They have a writer's group with interesting, but you know, not too quirky characters, because sometimes some cozies that I won't say their names here. They go overboard with the quirk.
Too generous with the quirkiness.
It's like, it gets ridiculous. Yeah. But this one, they're not too bad, really. And the main character, Olivia, she joins this writer's group. And it's actually kind of cute because Ellery Adams sprinkles bits of each of the writers' first novels that they're writing throughout the book. So there's there's a romance, there's a mystery, yeah, there's a paranormal. And it's just kind of, it's interesting to me. And it's kind of funny. So Olivia is independently wealthy, which is what a great setup, you know.
Yeah.
She owns a really nice restaurant, like a 5-star chef. You get some food talk and some interesting things that go on at the restaurant. Just a great little setup there. She also fixes up a lighthouse during this book that she owns.
I love that.
I love renovation. Right, I love remodel talk in books.
Are there any hauntings in it?
No, this is not a paranormal.
Okay, not a paranormal. Mm-hmm. Okay.
However, there is a hunky new bookstore owner who happens to be Olivia's age, single.
Yeah, sure. Hello.
And there's a hot single sheriff.
Ooh.
What?
Yeah.
Who likes to read.
Well, of course, because all sheriffs love to read.
And is interested in writing a novel.
Oh, okay. All right.
So, all like interesting stuff, good stuff.
You know, cops do have lots of stories, so.
They do. I know. And like good crime fiction, right?
I'm sure they would. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and also, Dave, someone does get murdered. It is a mystery.
Oh, okay, I guess so.
And Olivia helps solve the crime.
You would have to have a mystery.
Yeah, so just like all good cozies, you know, this crime is secondary, tertiary, ancillary to the small town.
All the Aries.
And the characters. I really like the main character, Olivia. She's prickly. At first, I wasn't sure about her at all. But then I really came to like her. She's one of my favorite cozy characters that I've seen in a while. I can see why this is a really popular series. It's very enjoyable, and I'm looking forward to her other books. In fact, I just went to the library today and picked up another first.
Oh, yeah, I saw that on the kitchen counter.
I think it's something with scone, books and scones or something.
Like, some kind of food.
It's another Ellery Adams. So.
Well, listeners, you'll be hearing about that one later. So
I'll
look forward to that.
Sprinkle that in so we don't get too Ellery Adams out.
Ellery'd out.
And another thing about Ellery Adams, I've seen that name for so long, and it doesn't really matter. Gender doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I always assumed it was a man for some reason.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yeah.
I thought it was a woman, Ellery.
Good for you.
All right. And that book is recommended by
Laura Medicus.
All right, my book this week,
Dave Medicus,
is titled New Girl in Little Cove by Dom Haight Monahan.
How do you spell the first name?
This is an interesting name. I think it's an Irish name, Damhnait. And this is one of those names where I try to look up online how to pronounce it. Well, they've got 15 different pronouncers from every country, so I don't really. I'm going to go with Damhnait Monahan. Anyway, this is a really good
somehow
book.
I don't think that's it.
Yeah. Anyway, let's get back to my book, New Girl in Little Cove. This is a story of a young woman named Rachel. Now, Rachel is from Toronto, and she accepts a position teaching French at a small town in Newfoundland. Now, Andrew, you and I, we grew up on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and you know what they would call people from the Western Shore.
Chicken neckers.
That's right. They would call them chicken neckers. Now, here in Newfoundland, if you come from Canada, the mainland, you would they would be called, anyone guess? As we all of a sudden, the cicadas are coming out. So if you hear
Landers?
Some mainlanders.
Yeah.
Good point. Mainlanders or mainlanders. Not quite as derogatory sounding as chicken neckers. Huh. However, the sentiment is the same. You are an outsider and you may not be welcome here, such is the situation facing Rachel. Now, this is the classic newcomer in a small town tale. Now, she has to ingratiate herself into the town's good graces, despite the fact there are those who don't want her here. In fact, someone is leaving threatening notes on her windshield on her car. I love the feel of the book. You really get to know the main character, Rachel. You empathize with her. She sets about her journey, especially, you know, as I'm a teacher and I could relate to everything she goes through, especially, I mean, I was out for a hike listening to them describe her first day in the classroom in this new small town, and she's the outsider. And this is her first year teaching. Oh, I was like cringing, recalling my early days of teaching. And that first year is brutal. You just don't know what the hell you're doing.
Have you guys ever been to Newfoundland?
Yeah, well, we have.
No, we haven't. We went to Prince Edward Island. We never went to Newfoundland.
We didn't go to Newfoundland.
Newfoundland's beautiful. I'm just looking it up.
And I think I've been there. I think I took a high-speed ferry from...
that sounds about right.
From Bar Harbor,
yeah,
Maine.
Yeah, because that's right. We went
to... That sounds about right.
Nova Scotia and Prince Edward Island.
It looks like Nova Scotia, but it's... It's so beautiful.
And this book is really a love letter to Newfoundland.
I'd like to go there.
It really made me want to go visit it.
Yeah. It's on the wrong coast for us.
It is. It's way on the other side. I love the way the people talk in this book. You get a feel for the different way they have a whole different dialect, a whole different way of talking. In fact, they'll put an S at the end of present tense verbs. So instead of saying I'm going to the store, they say, I goes to the store, you know, and it's kind of just this weird way of talking. Or they'll say, it's all very Irish. In fact, they say, instead of saying, I'm going to watch some TV, they say, I'm after watching some TV. You know how the Irish say, I'm after this, I'm after that, I'm after getting myself a soda, or I'm after a
I don't know that, but I believe it. I don't remember.
Yeah, they talk like they have their own way
of speaking. They definitely do.
And it's not a wrong way of speaking, is that's their dialect.
No, you know, I understand.
That's the way they speak. It's really fascinating. The author dives a little bit into that, and it's really, really interesting. I learned an awful lot about Newfoundland in reading this book.
Let's go. They've opened the borders.
Let's go. Yeah. The story
probably
itself
close the borders right when we get there.
It's about how she's able to kind of, she has to get to learn the new customs. She has to adapt and accept the traditions, the beliefs of Newfoundlanders. And it's a lot of fun to watch her journey and how she just interacts with the members of the community and their kind of idiosyncrasies. Like, Laura, I think you might like this. Do you know what they put in their tea? Not milk, not cream, not heavy cream, but it's a milky. This is something you enjoy. It's
is it
sweet.
Evaporated milk? Sweetened condensed milk?
Yes, the condensed milk. They put the condensed milk in their tea. I don't know if it's sweetened. It might have been sweetened, but
it's always sweet.
I guess the condensed milk is always sweetened, isn't it?
I don't know if it is.
She also...
That's what they do at that tea shop that Sylvie and I like to go to.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, it's really, really good.
I wonder if
and
it's
I got
run
some
by
of that,
a Newfoundlander.
That leche goods. They got this.
Oh yeah, that's a little bit different. I think
it's
that's very similar, though.
Sweet,
but it's similar. Yeah.
Yeah, it's delicious.
Maybe not quite as thick as the condensed milk.
It's pretty thick. Yeah.
Now Rachel also becomes
not healthy.
She becomes. She joins up with a group of women and becomes a hooker in this book. Now,
what?
Do you know what a hooker is? Now, I know you know what a hooker is.
No.
But in Newfoundland parlance.
No.
Or at least in this book, in Little Cove.
They're fishing.
Ooh, good guess, Andrew. No. It's a group of women. They like to sit around, hook, and gossip.
Rug hooking?
Yes. There you go. Let's give you
check
this.
Check out the big brain hook.
Laura Medicus.
Yes.
It's a cute... This
call
looks like...
the hookers.
Like... It's a really cute cover.
I love the cover. And the cover there, it's a whimsical cover. It really captures the feel.
It's kind of chick-lit, and I don't mean that in a bad way.
Oh, no, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not. I love this book. This book is quirky, different, it's tender, touching, very much character-driven, including the Newfoundland itself and the town itself as a character. I laughed. I welled up with tears in this one. Really enjoyed it. This is a New Girl in Little Cove. And this is by Domhnaill Monaghan. Check it out. Andrew Dowd. As the cicadas and the chorus.
Yeah, if you hear a hissing noise or something behind us, it's cicadas.
It's just the cicadas.
We also have Brutex. We didn't get any press on them.
That's right. No, we don't.
Like East Coast did.
The cicadas are louder here than they are at my house for some reason.
Are they really?
Andrew, they are so loud sometimes. I'll hear them from inside the home and think it's like a car alarm going off. Yep. I'm not joking.
Yeah. No, it gets pretty bad. I know in Maryland, there are certain times when it was like easily two or three times as loud as this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the book I read this week is called Lost Contact. Hmm. And no, this is not an electrical repair manual.
I was thinking, this happens to me often as I'm down on my hands and knees because I have lost a contact.
Yeah. Yeah, it is not.
Lens.
Yeah. And so the book is written by Nathan Hystad, Hystad.
Oh, did not get that. Okay.
This is the first book in a 3-book series. I think they refer to that as a trilogy.
That is
trilogy.
That is correct.
And the trilogy is called The Bridge Sequence. Now, The Bridge is referring to really sort of a wormhole, from Earth to some other world. Right.
Oh, all right.
And that's something. As you read the book, you will find out a little bit about that. And so, the main character in this book is Rex Walker. Now, this book is really a cross between Raiders of the Lost Ark and 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Mm. Oh, wow, that's an interesting cross.
Anytime I hear that Indiana Jones theme song, my face, I can't help it. I smile.
You can't help but break out in a smile.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that a...
So good. John Williams, yes, yeah. It is. Yep.
He likes a trumpet.
He does.
See, yeah. See, you wonder what Harrison Ford thinks about when he hears this theme song.
Money.
Is he thinking...
cash register sounds.
Not again.
He's thinking that. Cash register sounds lottery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, if I run into him, I'm going to pull up that music and just play it. I won't say a word. I'm just going to sit there and play that song. And
I mean, he's a guy who was in Star Wars, right?
Sure, another John Williams.
I mean, he's got amazing theme songs. You imagine being the heartthrob in Star Wars, and then to be one of the biggest Indiana. I mean, what a life! What a life!
I do. And
then to be crashing planes. In his late 70s.
That's true. Oh, Harrison.
Yeah. So,
and I should say my mother-in-law ran into him.
Really?
At a small airport in the Midwest.
Oh, really?
That's funny.
And she got all girly.
Sure. It's right? Harrison Ford.
I'm using the word girly.
Yes. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And so she's like
so defensive.
And she's like, Harrison, you're my hero.
Oh no.
She's just like, because she's like all starstruck.
Oh.
And so Harrison looks at her and he's like, I'm not really your hero. And she's like, yeah, no, I didn't know what to say. So
he seems kind of intimidating. Like I feel like he doesn't really want to hear from you.
I feel like he doesn't either.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
He's Harrison effing Ford.
Well, you know, if that's true, he's done a really good job, because if I was his level of fame, I couldn't handle it.
No, I wouldn't want to deal with anybody either.
I wouldn't want to deal with that.
So speaking of archaeologists, so Rex Walker is the main character in the book. Mm-hmm. And he is an archaeology teacher by day. And he kind of sneaks in, researching sort of the ancient aliens. By night. But he doesn't really let anybody know, right? Very few people know that he's actually searching for ancient aliens.
So the book is the book set in the future then?
No, it's really sort of more the present day.
Huh.
Right?
But like there's ancient...
Where's he finding these ancient aliens?
Well, so we'll get this.
Okay,
so,
all right.
So he comes by it...
I'm a bit confuddled.
He comes by it honestly because his father was a Harvard graduate. He was a Harvard professor. And his father was considered a brilliant archaeologist, but his father basically searched for alien artifacts. Mm-hmm. And his father basically went missing. So like 30 some years earlier, his dad went missing. He went to, you know, Peru or someplace, and he never came back. And you know, one of his assistants also never came back. And so partly what Rex is doing is he's following in his father's footsteps, but he doesn't want anybody to know that he's searching for his dad. Now, part of it is he doesn't want to kind of think, oh, is this wacky guy? He's searching for aliens.
Yeah. Right.
But he also doesn't know what happened to his dad.
Huh.
And Rex, of course, has in some places, he realized that people are following him. People with guns.
Ooh.
And so there really
Men
is
in black.
Yeah, there really is a sense of danger. And the people following him, they're a cult called the Believers. And so, you know, that's one of the things Rex is trying to do is he's trying to solve the mystery of what happened to his dad, and he's never been able to let it go. And he never believed his dad actually died. You know, it's something like every day he would go and visit his gravesite after his dad was missing, but he's never really accepted that his dad is gone. And so he's trying to solve that mystery, and then he's also trying to solve this other mystery, you know, of who these aliens were, you know, and what happened. And so he also has a former student. His name is Marcus, and he's a brilliant, you know, computer guy who studied archaeology. But of course, he realized, you know, there's not much of a living to be made, you know, doing archaeology. And so Marcus is basically also helping Rex to kind of search for these things, right? Mm-hmm. And they both kind of believe in aliens, right? Not like, you know, in your face, I believe in aliens, but kind of, you know, on the down low, you know, we kind of believe in aliens and we're looking for proof.
Right.
Right? And so that's the premise of the book, but things kind of shift into high gear when out near Pluto, an object is detected. And the object is moving, and it's pretty clear that this object is not, you know, it's not an asteroid, that it is some sort of a created object.
Do you think that'll ever happen to us?
I mean, who knows? You know, I'm not going to.
And will
I'm
the,
not, I'm not gonna
and
answer
will
that.
The government tell us?
Yes and no. I think it will happen, and we'll know. No, I don't think. I don't foresee it happening.
Question is, has it already happened?
I know.
That's true.
But the thing is, why do they like touch down, take a look, and then head back out again?
Yeah, but somebody's government would let us know, right? I mean, not
they
every
say,
single
pilots say they
gonna
see weird stuff all the time.
Yeah.
And it's like things touching down, taking a look, and then heading back out into space again.
So, you know, I have a family member who's, you know, passed away, former veteran. He was a Navy SEAL before the Navy SEALs existed. You know, brilliant guy at his PhD, you know, brilliant, you know, veteran, you know, real hero. And he told me a story that one time his submarine surfaced in the middle of the ocean somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, hundreds of miles from any landmass. And he's like, and we saw things in the middle of the ocean we can't explain.
Really?
What?
Right? Now,
wow.
You know, no explanations. I could just say firsthand, right? They,
wow.
This hardened, really tough guy admitted to seeing something.
I've heard that.
Now, I also
he'd also been trapped on a submarine for months. So
yeah. That's true.
He'd probably been having some hardcore.
But you do hear that
drugs.
About from like pilots or stuff like that.
And this is the other my other you know sort of firsthand experience is when I lived in the Middle East, I basically would go to the beach every weekend, this private beach, where for the most part I was trapped all weekend with these former British military, who are basically now contracted. To teach the Saudis how to fly planes, how to fix planes.
Oh.
So these are people that are familiar with, you know, state-of-the-art British, you know, military aircraft technology. And multiple people there told stories where they saw things.
Wow.
And they're like, you know, we know that there's no human technology that could do the things that we saw.
Wow.
So, you know, so in this, I know at least multiple examples of, I mean, really ex-military very credible witness that saw
who
things.
Would have no reason to
exactly
say these
no. And yeah. I used to be a big doubter, but the more they publish things reports that have been like covered up, the more it starts to become like, maybe there is something. Yeah, it seems too coincidental that all of those people, like you said, Andrew, and these are people, men and women, who are, if they're in military, there's not a lot of gray area for you sometimes in the military. It's black and white. Like, you either see it or you don't, you know?
And I wouldn't say I'm a believer, but I know that there's things we can't explain.
Yeah.
And, you know, I at least allow for the possibility of it.
Yeah. So that book sounds kind of cool, because if they're like, oh, there's something in Pluto, I think, oh, yeah.
And so
that's right.
Yeah.
And so this object coming from Pluto sets the clock ticking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Marcus give Rex a call, and he's like, hey, have you seen the news? Turn the news on, man. Check this out. He's like, this is it. Hmm. This is it.
Oh.
But it starts the clock ticking.
Wow.
And so, you know, other things happen where Rex kicks his search into overdrive, and he's finally found some clues which are really going to start to tie things together. And, you know, and so what it comes down to is there's some ancient alien technology that they suspect is going to open a bridge. And Rex also finds evidence that his dad opened the bridge and went through it.
Wow.
So now he's also hopeful that if I open the bridge, I can find out what happened to my father.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems there's two alien factions. There's the believers, and then there's this other group that created the bridge. And the believers kind of think that these aliens from Pluto are going to come, and they're going to really take control of the Earth, right? But the believers think that they're going to be, you know, put in positions of power, right, to control it.
Mm.
But the bridge may be the only connection, the only way of actually, you know, confronting or dealing with, right, the believers.
Hmm.
And so the believers basically want to stop. I mean, you know, murder, it doesn't matter. They will go to all costs to basically stop, you know, Rex from being successful, right? And they're very connected. They are everywhere, you know, and so that's kind of the battle you have there. And it really is a cross between Raiders of the Lost Ark and 2001 A Space Odyssey.
That's cool.
So you really get a little bit of both.
Sounds good. Can you play that and Star Wars?
Oh, yeah.
Let's hear those together.
Sure. Let's see what we got here. Ready?
Yep. Oh. No. Sorry.
Yeah. They're on the same...
See how much trumpet he likes?
They're on the same mixer.
A lot of trumpet.
The same channel, so it just kind of drowns out.
Good to be a trumpeter for John Williams.
So the book is Lost Contact by Nathan Heistat.
Okay, that sounds really good, Andrew. That sounds like it'd make a good movie.
Let me try to... Let's see if we can try this and then turn this.
No. It's the trumpets. There's way too many trumpets. Too much.
John, what are you doing? John, hello. Are you with us, John? Okay. All right.
You gotta stop.
Stop.
Let's pull that plug, baby.
Sorry, man. All right, Andrew, that sounds like a great book. And that means it's time for the
Audiobook of the Week.
And my pick this week is called The House Guest by Emily Richards. And this is performed by Vanessa Johansson. This book is part mystery, part women's fiction. Kind of hard to pin down to a certain genre. What it is, though, is captivating.
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
You read and listen to a lot of women's fiction.
I do.
And you don't have any problems with it.
No, absolutely.
And I got to tell you, my whole life I've read quote unquote men's fiction.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I haven't had any problems with it.
Yeah, so America, get over
yourselves.
Maybe
we stop calling it women's fiction.
That's a
I guess
great
we
point,
have
yeah.
to until it's equal. But it's getting there. It's getting really good.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, women's fiction, it's just another way of saying the main character is a woman, for goodness sakes.
I know, but I feel like it loses when you do something like that sometimes. I feel like it means that a man's not going to pick it up and read it. Mm-hmm. When it's just as good.
Yeah, it's just all it's going to do. By
it's clearly just fiction.
By calling it women's fiction,
I feel like you're more likely to isolate the men.
Push men away. Yeah, that's a good point. So,
but I, yeah,
that's a really good point.
I don't know.
I'll tell you what it is.
Debates.
It's interesting.
Sorry.
All right, and if you're like me, it will keep you entertained as you try to figure out how this tale will unfold. So there's a number of characters in this one. One of the main characters is a woman named Cassie. Now, Cassie. and her stepdaughter, Savannah, and Savannah is a high schooler. They have recently moved down to Tarpon Springs, Florida. Do you know where Tarpon Springs is?
I think so, yeah.
It sounds familiar.
I think it's on the west side, isn't it? Near Ocala, maybe?
I don't remember. You don't remember.
You looked it up and don't remember.
Yeah, isn't that funny? Mm-hmm. I just looked at a lot of pictures of it, so I didn't geographically look it up. As you're doing that,
yeah.
I will tell, is it on the west side? West side?
Yes, it is.
So Cassie and her stepdaughter, Savannah, they moved down to Tarpon Springs.
It's just
north
of Clearwater.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of struggling to come to grips with the death of Savannah's father and Cassie's husband.
I think I have family in Tarpon Springs.
Well, I would feel like that's something you should know. Who?
My mother's cousin, Jewel, I believe, lives in Tarpon Springs.
Oh, this is the place where we've been invited to go stay.
Yes, and well, I looked it up before, and I looked at it, and I thought, wow, this is lovely. I must go.
It sounds delightful. After reading this book,
Except they're filled with the Delta variant right now, so not this moment.
So in this book, Savannah is with her stepmother. Her real mother is still alive, yet her real mother seems to be more interested in doing her own thing than raising her daughter. So that now falls to her stepmom, Cassie. Now, when Savannah decides to throw a party at their house when her stepmom is away to impress her new classmates, she makes some bad choices, and it ends up adversely affecting another woman named Amber and her teenage son, Will. Mm. Suddenly, Amber and Will find themselves homeless.
Whoa.
Without enough money to pay the rent.
Wow.
Yes. When Savannah's stepmom finds out what happened and the choices that Savannah made, well, she invites Amber and Will to stay with them and become their house guests. Hence the title, The House Guests. Cool. What happens next is plenty of tension and growing pains as all the different characters struggle in their own way. The book has a lot of Greek. I really enjoyed it. It has a lot of Greek flavor to it, as Cassie is Greek. And we get to meet her extended family. There's a Yaya, they call the grandmother Yaya in it. And she runs a Greek restaurant. Listen, if you're one who listens to audiobooks in the car, if you're driving around listening to this one, you're probably going to find yourself pulling up into the parking lot of a Greek restaurant because it will make you hungry. The characters came alive to me, felt very real. The storyline is interesting, including the mystery. There's a mystery that involves who Will's father is. There are secrets that are kept and divulged. I enjoyed it. Let's take a listen to a clip. This is The House Guests by Emily Richards.
On Sunday morning, Savannah was afraid she was going to die, but not fast enough. She lifted her head from her pillow and the room spun. For a moment, she imagined herself on a carousel like the one in Central Park. As a little girl, she had loved going round and round on her favorite white horse, her father on a black one, while Cassie took their photos from the ground. Spinning wasn't fun now. She barely made it to the ensuite bathroom before she lost the contents of her stomach. The party. She plopped down on the edge of the bathtub and tried to remember if the party had really happened last night, or if she was caught in some kind of horrible time warp. Light was coming in through the glass block window, but was it sun or the security lights in the back of the house? She was still wearing last night's jeans and t-shirt. Would she open the door into the hall to find the party was still in full swing? Hordes and hordes of kids who hadn't been invited swirling through her alcohol-fogged brain, turning over furniture, throwing a beach ball at Cassie's beloved houseplants like they were bowling pins.
All right, there you go. That is your
audiobook.
And that'll do it for us this week. Thank you guys so much for joining us. We will be back later on for another show at some point in time. My name is Dave Medicus. We'll see you later.
Adios.
Be happy with being you. Love your flaws, own your quirks, and know that you are just as perfect as anyone else, exactly as you are. And then it's from the sage of our day, Ariana Grande.
Okay.
What about the women?